for my mother. She read to me when I was little, so now I'm returning the favour, and you're welcome to listen along. It's Sunday, and that means I'm reading a classic. Thursdays are for offbeat stuff, but whatever I'm reading, it's always great writing. Tonight, I am reading the opening two chapters of Vanity Fair, a very arch satire of English social climbing and class snobbery by author William Makepeace Thackeray. It is a classic of English literature, except that Thackeray never really intended it to be so. It was a serial, 19 monthly instalments beginning in 1848. But it was hugely popular, and thank goodness, because Thackeray had gambled away his inheritance and needed to make a living, and writing was how he did it. Thackeray's fans always let him know what they wanted to see happen in the story of Vanity Fair as it was going along, because it took more than 19 months to tell, and Thackeray was happy to oblige. So he never really knew where the story was going. He kind of did, but he really just knew that he had to write it. And Vanity Fair is a triumph of great writing. Thackeray was able to tell this remarkable story of Becky Sharp and Amelia Sedley as well and as beautifully as he did because he was such a talented writer. In fact, so talented that Thackeray was considered another Dickens, as in Charles Dickens. That's how beloved he was as an author. Vanity Fair is set in the early 19th century in England, and a bit in France and a bit in Germany. The period is pre-Victorian. Victoria had not become the Queen yet. That happened in 1837. Think of the period as involving the Napoleonic Wars, the Battle of Waterloo and all that, 1815 or so to about 1830. That's the time range. That's where we are. Empire line dresses and high hairdos for the ladies, long boots and long hats for the lads. It's the story of two young women, the lovely, good-hearted Amelia Sedley, who is so nice that she could bore for England, and the other, Becky Sharp. Pretty, poor, very bright and charming, who always makes the immoral choice. She's the original mean girl. The character of Becky Sharp is, well, there's no polite way to say it. She's a roll gold bitch on stilts. Pardon my French, but there it is. She is a tremendous literary character. She's very pretty and rather venal. Always social climbing, always grasping for money, never making a moral choice. Classic literature is not filled with such characters as the main event, the lead story. Thackeray was quite courageous to write Becky Sharp into the world the way he did, because for sure there was no shortage of such strong-willed, grasping women in that actual period of history. There just wasn't any vision of them in literature to that time. Becky Sharp today would be called a hustler, a grifter, a gold digger. But Thackeray spends a lot of time with her, so we really get to understand what makes her tick and why. So she is dislikable, but somehow still fascinating and appealing. Vanity Fair is also a story of England and snobbery and the constant grind for social acceptance and betterment. Some of you may have seen one of many TV and film versions and adaptations of the story. I would say give the 2004 movie a miss because it's not really an adaptation. It's more of a rewrite of the story, so it's not at all faithful to the original. But the 2018 BBC TV series version is a very faithful rendering, and it is a terrific production as well, so definitely worth a watch. The story follows Becky Sharp's ups and downs, and those of Amelia Sedley, in a way that highlights snobbery, cold, rational, loveless marriage decisions, and the constant threat of war with Napoleon. Vanity Fair really is a terrific read. It's rather long, given those 19 monthly instalments, but it has a breakneck speed, so don't be daunted by the length. Let's meet Becky Sharp and Amelia Sedley, shall we, as they are leaving Miss Pinkerton's School for Girls in William Makepeace Thackeray's Vanity Fair. Let's begin. While the present century was in its teens, and on one sunshiny morning in June, there drove up to the great iron gate of Miss Pinkerton's Academy for Young Ladies, on Chiswick Mall, a large family coach, with two fat horses in blazing harness, driven by a fat coachman in a three-cornered hat and wig at the rate of 4 miles an hour. A black servant who reposed on the box beside the fat coachman uncurled his bandy legs as soon as the coach drew up opposite Miss Pinkerton's shining brass plate, and as he pulled the bell, at least a score of young heads were seen peering out of the narrow windows of the stately old brick house. The acute observer may have recognised the little red nose of good-natured Miss Jemima Pinkerton herself, rising over some geranium pots in the window of that lady's own drawing room. "It is Mrs. Sedley's coach, sister," said Miss Jemima. "The black servant has just rung the bell. The coachman has a new red waistcoat." "Have you completed all the necessary preparations incident to Miss Sedley's departure, Miss Jemima?" asked Miss Pinkerton herself, that majestic lady. "The girls were up at 4 this morning, packing her trunks, sister," replied Miss Jemima. "We have made her a beaupot." "Please say bouquet, Sister Jemima, 'tis more genteel." "Well, it's a bookie as big as a haystack. I have put up 2 bottles of the gillyflower water for Mrs. Sedley and a receipt for making it in Amelia's box." "And I trust, Miss Jemima, you have made a copy of Miss Sedley's account? This is it, is it? Very good. £93.04. Be kind enough to address it to Mr. John Sedley, Esquire, and to seal this billet, which I have written to his lady." In Miss Jemima's eyes, an autograph letter of her sister, Miss Barbara Pinkerton, was an object of as deep veneration as would have been a letter from a sovereign. Only when her pupils quitted the establishment, or when they were about to be married, and once, when poor Miss Birch died of the scarlet fever, was Miss Pinkerton known to write personally to the parents of her pupils. And it was Jemima's opinion that if anything could console Mrs. Birch for her daughter's loss, it would be that pious and eloquent composition in which Miss Barbara Pinkerton announced the event. In the present instance, Miss Pinkerton's billet was to the following effect. "Madam, after her 6 years' residence at the Mall, I have the honour and happiness of presenting Miss Amelia Sedley to her parents, as a young lady not unworthy to occupy a fitting position in their polished and refined circle. Those virtues which characterise the young English gentlewoman, those accomplishments which become her birth and station, will not be found wanting in the amiable Miss Sedley, whose industry and obedience have endeared her to her instructors, and whose delightful sweetness of temper has charmed her aged and her youthful companions. In music, in dancing, in orthography, in every variety of embroidery and needlework, she will be found to have realised her friend's fondest wishes. In geography, there is still much to be desired, and a careful and undeviating use of the backboard for 4 hours daily during the next 3 years is recommended as necessary to the acquirement of that dignified deportment and carriage so requisite for every young lady of fashion. In the principles of religion and morality, Miss Sedley will be found worthy of an establishment which has been honoured by the presence of the great lexicographer, Dr. Samuel Johnson. In leaving the Mall, Miss Amelia carries with her the hearts of her companions and the affectionate regards of her mistress, who has the honour to subscribe herself, Madame, your most obliged humble servant, Barbara Pinkerton. P.S. Miss Sharp accompanies Miss Sedley. It is particularly requested that Miss Sharp's stay in Russell Square may not exceed 10 days. The family of distinction with whom she is engaged desire to avail themselves of her services as soon as possible. This letter completed, Miss Pinkerton proceeded to write her own name and Miss Sedley's in the flyleaf of a Dr. Samuel Johnston dictionary, the interesting work which she invariably presented to her scholars on their departure from the mall. On the cover was inserted a copy of Lines Addressed to a Young Lady on Quitting Miss Pinkerton's School at the Mall by the late Reverend Dr. Samuel Johnston. In fact, the lexicographer's name was always on the lips of this majestic woman, and a visit he had paid to her was the cause of her reputation and her fortune. Being commanded by her elder sister to get the dictionary from the cupboard, Miss Jemima had extracted 2 copies of the book from the receptacle in question. When Miss Pinkerton had finished the inscription in the first, Jemima, with rather a dubious and timid air, handed her the 2nd. "For whom is this, Miss Jemima?" said Miss Pinkerton, with awful coldness. "For Becky Sharp," answered Jemima, trembling very much and blushing over her withered face and neck as she turned her back on her sister. "For Becky Sharp, she's going too." "Miss Jemima," exclaimed Miss Pinkerton in the largest capitals, "are you in your senses? Replace the dictionary in the closet and never venture to take such a liberty in future." "Well, sister, it's only 2 and 9 pence, and poor Becky will be miserable if she don't get one." "Ugh, send Miss Sedley instantly to me," said Miss Pinkerton, and so, venturing not to say another word, poor Jemima trotted off, exceedingly flurried and nervous. Miss Sedley's papa was a merchant in London and a man of some wealth, whereas Miss Sharp was an articled pupil for whom Miss Pinkerton had done, as she thought, quite enough without conferring upon her at parting the high honour of one of her dictionaries. Although schoolmistresses' letters are to be trusted no more or less than churchyard epitaphs, yet, as it sometimes happens that a person departs this life who is really deserving of all the praise the stone-cutter carves over his bones, who is a good Christian, a good parent, child, wife, or husband, who actually does leave a disconsolate family to mourn his loss, so in academies of the male and female sex, it occurs every now and then that the pupil is fully worthy of the praises bestowed by the disinterested instructor. Now, Miss Amelia Sedley was a young lady of this singular species, and deserved not only all that Miss Pinkerton said in her praise, but had many charming qualities which that pompous old Minerva of a woman could not see, from the differences of rank and age between her pupil and herself. For she could not only sing like a lark, and embroider beautifully, and spell as well as a dictionary itself, but she had a kindly, smiling, tender, gentle, generous heart of her own, as won the love of everybody who came near her, from Minerva herself down to the poor girl in the scullery. Amelia had 12 intimate and bosom friends out of the 24 young ladies. Even envious Miss Briggs never spoke ill of her. High and mighty Miss Saltire allowed that her figure was genteel. And as for Miss Swartz, on the day Amelia went away, she was in such a passion of tears that they were obliged to send for Dr. Floss and half tipsify her with smelling salts. Miss Pinkerton's attachment was, as may be supposed from the high position and eminent virtues of that lady, calm and dignified. But Miss Jemima had already whimpered several times at the idea of Amelia's departure, and, but for fear of her sister, would have gone off in downright hysterics. Such luxury of grief, however, is only allowed to parlour boarders. Honest Jemima had all the bills, and the washing, and the mending, and the puddings, and the plate, and the crockery, and the servants to superintend. But why speak about her? It is probable we shall not hear of her again, from this moment to the end of time, and that when the great filigree iron gates are once closed on her, she and her awful sister will never issue therefrom into this little world of history. But as we are to see a great deal of Amelia, there is no harm in saying, at the outset of our acquaintance, that she was a dear little creature. And a great mercy it is, both in life and in novels, which, and the latter especially, abound in villains of the most sombre sort, that we are to have for a constant companion so guileless and good-natured a person. As she is not a heroine, there is no need to describe her person. Indeed, I am afraid that her nose was rather short than otherwise, and her cheeks a great deal too round and red for a heroine. But her face blushed with rosy health, and her lips with the freshest of smiles, and she had a pair of eyes which sparkled with the brightest and honestest good humour, except when they were filled with tears, and that was a great deal too often. For the silly thing would cry over a dead canary bird, or over a mouse that the cat had seized upon, or over the end of a novel, were it ever so stupid. And as for saying an unkind word to her, were any persons hard-hearted enough to do so, why, so much the worse for them. Even Miss Pinkerton, that austere and godlike woman, ceased scolding her after the first time, and though she no more comprehended sensibility than she did algebra, gave all masters and teachers particular orders to treat Miss Sedley with the utmost gentleness, as harsh treatment was injurious to her. So that when the day of departure came, between her two customs of laughing and crying, Miss Sedley was greatly puzzled how to act. She was glad to go home, and yet most woefully sad at leaving school. For 3 days before, little Laura Martin, the orphan, followed her about like a little dog. She had to make and receive at least 14 presents, to make 14 solemn promises of writing every week. "Send my letters under cover to my grandpapa, the Earl of Dexter," said Miss Saltire, who, by the way, was rather shabby. "Never mind the postage, but write every day, you dear darling," said the impetuous but generous Miss Swartz. And the orphan, little Laura Martin, took her friend's hand and said, looking up in her face wistfully, "Amelia, when I write to you, I shall call you Mama." Well, then, the flowers and the presents and the trunks and the bonnet boxes of Miss Sedley, having been arranged by the servant in the carriage, together with a very small and weather-beaten old cow's skin trunk with Miss Sharp's card neatly nailed on it, which was delivered by the servant with a grin and packed by the coachman with a corresponding sneer, the hour for parting came. And the grief of that moment was considerably lessened by the admirable discourse which Miss Pinkerton addressed to her pupil. Not that the parting speech caused Amelia to philosophize, or that it armed her in any way with a calmness the result of reason, but it was intolerably dull, pompous, and tedious, and having the fear of her schoolmistress greatly before her eyes, Miss Sedley did not venture, in her presence, to give way to any ebullitions of private grief. A seed cake and a bottle of wine were produced in the drawing room, as on the solemn occasions of the visits of parents, and these refreshments being partaken of, Miss Sedley was at liberty to depart. "You'll go in and say goodbye to Miss Pinkerton, Becky," said Miss Jemima to a young lady of whom nobody took any notice, and who was coming downstairs with her own bandbox. "I suppose I must," said Miss Sharp calmly, and much to the wonder of Miss Jemima, and the latter having knocked at the door and receiving permission to come in, Miss Sharp advanced in a very unconcerned manner and said in French and with a perfect accent, "Mademoiselle, Je viens vous faire mes adieux. Miss Pinkerton did not understand French. She only directed those who did. But biting her lips and throwing up her venerable and Roman-nosed head, on the top of which figured a large and solemn turban, she said, Miss Sharp, I wish you a good morning. As she spoke, she waved one hand, both by way of adieu and to give Miss Sharp an opportunity of shaking one of the fingers of the hand, which was left out for that purpose. Miss Sharp only folded her own hands with a very frigid smile and bow, and quite declined to accept the proffered honour, on which Miss Pinkerton tossed up her turban more indignantly than ever. In fact, it was a little battle between the young lady and the old one, and the latter was worsted. "Heaven bless you, my child," said she, embracing Amelia, and scowling the while over the girl's shoulder at Miss Sharp. "Come away, Becky," said Miss Jemima, pulling the young woman away in great alarm, and the drawing-room door closed upon them forever. Then came the struggle and parting below. Words refused to tell it. All the servants were there in the hall, all the dear friends, all the young ladies, the dancing-master who had just arrived, and there was such a scuffling and hugging and kissing and crying with the hysterical youps of Miss Swartz as no pen can depict. The embracing was over. They parted. That is, Miss Sedley parted from her friends. Miss Sharp had demurely entered the carriage some minutes before. Nobody cried for leaving her. The servant slammed the carriage door on his young, weeping mistress. He sprang up behind the carriage. "Stop," cried Miss Jemima, rushing to the gate with a parcel. "It's some sandwiches, my dear," she said to Amelia. "You may be hungry, you know. And Becky Sharp, here's a book for you that my sister, that is, Dr. Johnson's dictionary, you know. You mustn't leave us without that. Goodbye. Drive on, coachman. God bless you." And the kind creature retreated into the garden, overcome with emotion. But lo, and just as the coach drove off, Miss Sharp put her pale face out of the window and actually flung the book back into the garden. This almost caused Jemima to faint with terror. "Well, I never," said she. "What an audacious—" Emotion prevented her from completing either sentence. The carriage rolled away. The great gates were closed. The bell rang for the dancing lesson. The world is before the two young ladies, and so farewell to Chiswick Mall. When Miss Sharp had performed the heroical act mentioned in the last chapter and had seen the dictionary flying over the pavement of the little garden fall at length at the feet of the astonished Miss Jemima, the young lady's countenance, which had before worn an almost livid look of hatred, assumed a smile that perhaps was scarcely more agreeable, and she sank back in the carriage in an easy frame of mind, saying, "So much for the dictionary, and thank God I'm out of Chiswick." Miss Sedley was almost as flurried at the act of defiance as Miss Jemima had been, for consider it was but 1 minute that she had left the school, and the impressions of 6 years are not got over in that space of time. Nay, with some persons, those awes and terrors of youth last forever and ever. I know, for instance, an old gentleman of 68, who said to me one morning at breakfast, with a very agitated countenance, "I dreamed last night that I was flogged by Dr. Rain." Fancy had carried him back 55 years in the course of that evening. Dr. Rain and his rod were just as awful to him in his heart then at 68 as they had been at 13. Well, Miss Sedley was exceedingly alarmed at Becky Sharp's act of insubordination. "How could you do so, Rebecca?" at last she said after a pause. "Why, do you think Miss Pinkerton will come out and order me back to the black hole?" said Rebecca, laughing. "No, but I hate the whole house," continued Miss Sharp in a fury. "I hope I may never set eyes on it again. I wish it were at the bottom of the Thames, I do, and if Miss Pinkerton were there, I wouldn't pick her out, that I wouldn't. Oh, how I should like to see her floating in the water yonder, turban and all, with her train streaming after her and her nose like the beak of a wherry." "Oh, hush," cried Miss Sedley. "Why, will the servant man tell tales?" cried Miss Rebecca, laughing. "He may go back and tell Miss Pinkerton that I hate her with all my soul. And I wish he would. And I wish I had a means of proving it, too. For 2 years I have only had insults and outrage from her. I have been treated worse than any servant in the kitchen. I have never had a friend or a kind word, except from you. I have been made to tend the little girls in the lower schoolroom and to talk French to the missus, until I grew sick of my mother tongue. But that talking French to Miss Pinkerton now, that was capital fun, wasn't it? She doesn't know a word of French, and was too proud to confess it. I believe it was that which made her part with me. And so, thank heaven for French. Vive la France! Vive l'Empereur! Vive Bonaparte!" "Oh, Rebecca, Rebecca, for shame!" cried Miss Sedley, for this was the greatest blasphemy Rebecca had as yet uttered. And in those days, in England, to say long live Bonaparte was as much as to say long live Lucifer. "How can you, how dare you have such wicked, revengeful thoughts?" "Revenge may be wicked, but it's natural," answered Miss Rebecca. "I'm no angel." And, to say the truth, she certainly was not. For it may be remarked in the course of this little conversation, which took place as the coach rolled along lazily by the riverside, that though Miss Rebecca Sharp has twice had occasion to thank heaven, it has been, in the first place, for ridding her of some person whom she hated, and, secondly, for enabling her to bring her enemies to some sort of perplexity or confusion, neither of which are very amiable motives for religious gratitude, or such as would be put forward by persons of a kind and placable disposition. Miss Rebecca was not, then, in the least kind or placable. "All the world used her ill," said this young misanthropist, and we may be pretty certain that persons whom all the world treats ill deserve entirely the treatment they get. The world is a looking-glass, and gives back to every man the reflection of his own face. Frown at it, and it will look in turn sourly upon you. Laugh at it, and with it, and it is a jolly kind companion. And so let all young persons take their choice. This is certain, that if the world neglected Miss Sharp, she never was known to have done a good action in behalf of anybody. Nor can it be expected that 24 young ladies should all be as amiable as the heroine of this work, Miss Sedley, whom we have selected for the very reason that she was the best-natured of all. It could not be expected that everyone should be of the humble and gentle temper of Miss Amelia Sedley, should take every opportunity to vanquish Rebecca's hard-heartedness and ill-humour, and by 1,000 kind words and offices overcome, for once at least, her hostility to her kind. Miss Sharp's father was an artist, and in that quality had given lessons of drawing at Miss Pinkerton's school. He was a clever man, a pleasant companion, a careless student with a great propensity for running into debt, and a partiality for the tavern. When he was drunk, he used to beat his wife and daughter. And the next morning, with a headache, he would rail at the world for its neglect of his genius, and abuse, with a good deal of cleverness and sometimes with perfect reason, the fools, his brother painters. As it was with the utmost difficulty that he could keep himself, and as he owed money for a mile round Soho, where he lived, he thought to better his circumstances by marrying a young woman of the French nation, who was by profession an opera girl. The humble calling of her female parent Miss Sharp never alluded to, but Eustace states subsequently that the family was a noble one of Gascony and took great pride in her descent from them. And curious it is that as she advanced in life, this young lady's ancestors increased in rank and splendour. Rebecca's mother had had some education somewhere, and her daughter spoke French with purity and a Parisian accent. It was in those days rather a rare accomplishment and led to her engagement with the orthodox Miss Pinkerton. For her mother being dead, her father finding himself not likely to recover after his third attack of delirium tremens, wrote a manly and pathetic letter to Miss Pinkerton, recommending his orphan child to her protection, and so descended to the grave after two bailiffs had quarrelled over his corpse. Rebecca was 17 when she came to Chiswick and was bound over as an articled pupil, her duties being to talk French, as we have seen, and her privileges to live cost-free and with a few guineas a year to gather scraps of knowledge from the professors who attended the school. She was small and slight in person, pale, sandy-haired, and with eyes habitually cast down. When they looked up, they were very large, odd, and attractive. By the side of many tall and bouncing young ladies in the establishment, Rebecca Sharp looked like a child, but she had the dismal precocity of poverty. Many a dun had she talked to and turned away from her father's door. Many a tradesman had she coaxed and wheedled into good humour and into the granting of one meal more. She sat commonly with her father, who was very proud of her wit and heard the talk of many of his wild companions, often but ill-suited for a girl to hear. But she never had been a girl, she said. She had been a woman since she was 8 years old. Oh, why did Miss Pinkerton let such a dangerous bird into her cage? The fact is, the old lady believed Rebecca to be the meekest creature in the world, so admirably, on the occasions when her father brought her to Chiswick, used Rebecca to perform the part of the ingenue. And only a year before the arrangement by which Rebecca had been admitted into her house, and when Rebecca was 16 years old, Miss Pinkerton majestically, and with a little speech, made her a present of a doll. How the father and daughter laughed as they trudged home together after the evening party. It was on the occasion of the speeches when all the professors were invited. And how Miss Pinkerton would have raged had she seen the caricature of herself which the little mimic, Rebecca, managed to make out of her doll. Becky used to go through dialogues with it. It formed the delight of Newman Street, Gerrard Street, and the Artists' Quarter. And the young painters, when they came to take their gin and water with their lazy, dissolute, clever, jovial senior, used regularly to ask Rebecca if Miss Pinkerton was at home. She was as well known to them, poor soul, as Mr. Lawrence or President West. Once Rebecca had the honour to pass a few days at Chiswick, after which she brought back Jemima and erected another doll as Miss Jemmy. For though that honest creature had made and given her jelly and cake enough for three children and a 7-shilling piece at parting, the girl's sense of ridicule was far stronger than her gratitude, and she sacrificed Miss Jemmy quite as pitilessly as her sister. The catastrophe came, and she was brought to the mall as to her home. The rigid formality of the place suffocated her. The prayers and the meals, the lessons and the walks, which were arranged with a conventual regularity, oppressed her almost beyond endurance, and she looked back to the freedom and the beggary of the old studio in Soho with so much regret that everybody, herself included, fancied she was consumed with grief for her father. She had a little room in the garret, where the maids heard her, walking and sobbing at night, but it was with rage, not with grief. She had not been much of a dissembler until now her loneliness taught her to feign. She had never mingled in the society of women. Her father, reprobate as he was a man of talent. His conversation was 1,000 times more agreeable to her than the talk of her own sex as she now encountered. The pompous vanity of the old school mistress, the foolish good humour of her sister, the silly chat and scandal of the elder girls, and the frigid correctness of the governesses equally annoyed her. And she had no soft maternal heart, this unlucky girl. Otherwise, the prattle and talk of the younger children, with whose care she was chiefly entrusted, might have soothed and interested her. But she lived among them 2 years, and not one was sorry that she went away. The gentle, tender-hearted Amelia Sedley was the only person to whom she could attach herself in the least, and who could help attaching herself to Amelia. The happiness, the superior advantages of the young women round about her gave Rebecca inexpressible pangs of envy. "What airs that girl gives herself because she is an earl's granddaughter," she said of one. "How they cringe and bow to the Creole because of her 100,000 pounds. I am 1,000 times cleverer and more charming than that creature for all her wealth. I am as well bred as the earl's granddaughter for all her fine pedigree. And yet everyone passes me by here. When I was at my father's, didn't the men give up their gayest balls and parties in order to pass the evening with me?" She determined at any rate to get free from the prison in which she found herself, and now began to act for herself, and for the first time to make connected plans for the future. She took advantage, therefore, of the means of study the place offered her, and as she was already a musician and a good linguist, she speedily went through the little course of study which was considered necessary for ladies in those days. Her music she practiced incessantly, and one day, when the girls were out and she had remained at home, she was overheard to play a piece so well that Miss Pinkerton, Minerva, thought wisely she could spare herself the expense of a master for the juniors, and intimated to Miss Sharp that she was to instruct them in music for the future. The girl refused, and for the first time, and to the astonishment of the majestic mistress of the school. "I am here to speak French with the children," Rebecca said abruptly, "not to teach them music and save money for you. Give me money and I will teach them." Minerva was obliged to yield, and of course disliked her from that day. "For 35 years, she said, and with great justice, "I never have seen an individual who has dared in my own house to question my authority. I have nourished a viper in my bosom." "A viper, a fiddlestick," said Miss Sharp to the old lady, almost fainting with astonishment. "You took me because I was useful. There is no question of gratitude between us. I hate this place and want to leave it. I will do nothing here but what I am obliged to do." It was in vain that the old lady asked her if she was aware she was speaking to Miss Pinkerton. Rebecca laughed in her face with a horrid, sarcastic, demoniacal laughter that had almost sent the schoolmistress into fits. "Give me a sum of money," said the girl, "and get rid of me. Or, if you like better, get me a good place as governess in a nobleman's family. You can do so if you please." And in their further disputes, she always returned to this point. "Get me a situation. We hate each other, and I am ready to go." Worthy Miss Pinkerton, although she had a Roman nose and a turban, and was as tall as a grenadier, and had been up to this time an irresistible princess, had no will or strength like that of her little apprentice, and in vain did battle against her, and tried to overawe her. Attempting once to scold her in public, Rebecca hit upon the before-mentioned plan of answering her in French, which quite routed the old woman. In order to maintain authority in her school, it became necessary to remove this rebel this monster, this serpent, this firebrand. And hearing about this time that Sir Pitt Crawley's family was in want of a governess, she actually recommended Miss Sharp for the situation, firebrand and serpent as she was. "I cannot certainly," she said, "find fault with Miss Sharp's conduct, except to myself, and must allow that her talents and accomplishments are of a high order. As far as the head goes, at least, she does credit to the educational system pursued at my establishment." And so the schoolmistress reconciled the recommendation to her conscience, and the indentures were cancelled, and the apprentice was free. The battle here described in a few lines, of course, lasted for some months, and as Miss Sedley, being now in her 17th year, was about to leave the school, and had a friendship with Miss Sharp. "'Tis the only point in Amelia's behaviour," said Minerva, "which has not been satisfactory to her mistress." Miss Sharp was invited by her friend to pass a week with her at home before she entered upon her duties as governess in a private family. Thus the world began for these two young ladies. For Amelia, it was quite a new, fresh, brilliant world with all the bloom upon it. It was not quite a new one for Rebecca. At all events, if Rebecca was not beginning the world, she was beginning it over again. By the time the young ladies reached Kensington Turnpike, Amelia had not forgotten her companions, but had dried her tears. And when at length home was reached, Miss Amelia Sedley skipped out on the servant's arm, as happy and as handsome a girl as any in the whole big city of London. Both he and the coachman agreed on this point, and so did her father and mother, and so did every one of the servants in the house, as they stood bobbing and curtsying and smiling in the hall to welcome their young mistress. You may be sure that she showed Rebecca over every room of the house, and everything in every one of her drawers, and her books and her piano and her dresses and all her necklaces, brooches, laces and gimcracks. She insisted upon Rebecca accepting the white cornelian and the turquoise rings, and a sweet-sprigged muslin, which was too small for her now, though it would fit her friend to a nicety. And she determined in her heart to ask her mother's permission to present her white cashmere shawl to her friend. Could she not spare it, and had not her brother Joseph just bought her two from India? When Rebecca saw the two magnificent cashmere shawls which Joseph Sedley had brought home to his sister, she said with perfect truth that it must be delightful to have a brother, and easily got the pity of the tender-hearted Amelia for being alone in the world, an orphan, without friends or kindred. "Not alone," said Amelia. "You know, Rebecca, I shall always be your friend and love you as a sister. Indeed, I will." "Ah, but to have parents as you have, kind, rich, affectionate parents who give everything you ask for, and their love, which is more precious than all. My poor papa could give me nothing, and I had but two frocks in all the world. And then to have a brother, a dear brother, how you must love him." Amelia laughed. "What, don't you love him? You who say you love everybody?" "Yes, of course I do. I do. Only..." "Only what?" "Only Joseph doesn't seem to care much whether I love him or not. He gave me two fingers to shake when he arrived after 10 years' absence. He is very kind and good, but he scarcely ever speaks to me. I think he loves his pipe a great deal better than his..." But here Amelia checked herself. For why should she speak ill of her brother? "He was very kind to me as a child," she added. "I was but 5 years old when he went away." "Isn't he very rich?" said Rebecca. "They say all Indian nabobs are enormously rich." "I believe he has a very large income." "And is your sister-in-law a nice, pretty woman?" "Oh, ha! Joseph isn't married," said Amelia, laughing again. Perhaps she had mentioned the fact already to Rebecca, but that young lady did not appear to have remembered it. Indeed, vowed and protested that she expected to see a number of Amelia's nieces and nephews. She was quite disappointed that Mr. Sedley was not married. She was sure Amelia had said he was, and she doted so on little children. "I think you must have had enough of little children at Chiswick," said Amelia, rather wondering at the sudden tenderness on her friend's part. And indeed, in later days, Miss Sharp would never have committed herself so far as to advance opinions, the untruth of which would have been so easily detected. But we must remember that she is but 19 as yet, unused to the art of deceiving, poor innocent creature, and making her own experience in her own person. The meaning of the above series of queries, as translated in the heart of this ingenious young woman, was simply this. If Mr. Joseph Sedley is rich and unmarried, why should I not marry him? I have only a fortnight, to be sure, but there is no harm in trying. And she determined within herself to make this laudable attempt. She redoubled her caresses to Amelia. She kissed the white cornelian necklace as she put it on and vowed she would never, never part with it. When the dinner bell rang, she went downstairs with her arm round her friend's waist, as is the habit of young ladies. She was so agitated at the drawing-room door that she could hardly find courage to enter. "Feel my heart, Amelia, how it beats, dear," she said to her friend. "Oh, no, it doesn't," said Amelia. "Come on in, don't be frightened. Papa won't do you any harm." And that's where we'll leave it tonight. The world is a looking glass, and Becky Sharp looks in it and gives it the side eye. Thackeray hides nothing about Becky, does he? She's not nice, but she has her reasons. Miss Barbara Pinkerton is a snob, and her sister Miss Jemima Pinkerton knows it deep down and is rather foolish. So is it such a wrong thing that Becky and her father should have made fun of them both? Still, to be 19 years of age and already a cynic and manipulator, well, there's a word for that, which I already used earlier, and I won't repeat. Do give Vanity Fair a read if you can, because it is a rollicking story. Does Becky win in the end? Hell no, and that's no spoiler. Mean girls rarely do. But how she gets to where she gets is always engaging and fun. A great book, Vanity Fair, by William Makepeace Thackeray, a very talented writer. Right, that's your lot. I'll be back on Thursday, 9 p.m. Sydney time, with something offbeat, and I wish you all a great and safe week wherever you are. Do keep sharing the pod with friends and family who love great writing and the words of the past, and particularly share it with students, to help them appreciate that classic literature isn't stuffy. It's actually a lot of fun. Until next time then, take care. It's slippery out there. And thanks for listening to Needy Reads.